Up next, you talk about a strange story. Dr. Mary's Monkey, how the unsolved murder of a doctor, a secret lab in New Orleans, and a cancer-causing monkey virus are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and emerging global epidemics. Up next, Edward Heslam on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Now, you're going to take a journey with me tonight, and it is indeed a journey. Let me tell you first of all about our guest. Ed Heslam spent his first 35 years living in New Orleans. He personally heard and saw things that involved the investigation into the JFK assassination, the murder of one of his father's colleagues, and claims of biological weapons to be used for political purposes. Heslam's 1969 comment: if there is a bizarre global epidemic involving cancer and a monkey virus 30 years from now, at least we'll know where it came from, states his concerns very clearly. Here he is, Ed Heslam. Ed, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, George. I'm fine.
My pleasure. And I noticed a foreword by a guy I respect a lot who's going to be our guest on Coast to Coast this coming Monday, Jim Mars. There he is.
Yes, Jim. Jim's been with me on this story for a long time, and he's been a great support, and I talk to him all the time, and it's good to have him on board. In fact, we're doing I'm doing the foreword to a book, and he's doing the afterword to it that'll be released here in a couple of months now on a woman who's the witness in my book, and we'll talk about her a little bit, but it's me and Lee, which is her relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963. So Jim's definitely a member of the party here.
Ed, this is an incredible story. And when I say incredible, I'm putting it in quotes and in big letters. It is one of the strangest mysteries that I have ever read or come across. But I want to ask you about you, first of all, because that is equally strange. I mean, you're not a doctor. You've been in what, the advertising business?
Yeah, and that was my career. I think of myself as a writer nowadays, but I grew up around medicine. My father was a professor at Tulane Medical School, which is how I got my initial leads on this story. And this story really came to me. I didn't go to it. I just grew up with the pieces surrounding me, and it was like I had this big puzzle, and one day I sat down and started to lay out the pieces and connect the dots. And the problem with the story, and I put problem in quotes there, is the fact that when you look at the story, each piece fits in with each other piece very cleanly and very logically. And it's only when you stand back and look at it that it looks really as strange as it does.
Tell us a little bit more about your background now, and then how you got involved in this kind of research.
Well, I am a professional writer by just due to my advertising background. But really, what you were talking about in the 1950s and 1960s, when I grew up in New Orleans, is where I started being handed the pieces of this. And it was all I couldn't explain it to anybody because I didn't have the internet and the libraries and the documentation that we have today. And it wasn't until, and I did have this fear, as you pointed out by the quote, from 1969, that we were going to have this terrible global epidemic involving cancer and a monkey virus. But that was difficult to explain to people, too, until it showed up. And then in the 1980s, when the mainstream scientific establishment started saying that AIDS was a mutation of a monkey virus, I started to have real serious concerns. And then I heard some information about some similar sounding stuff in New Orleans, which all tracked with these pieces of the puzzle that I had collected over the years. And I said, somebody has got to lay all this stuff out and compare what we know about the people that were mutating monkey viruses in New Orleans in 1960 and this never seen before global epidemic that's killed more people than war that's sweeping the planet today. And I initially really started looking for the flaw in the argument because I wasn't real anxious to be the messenger on this. And it's not a particularly happy story to come out with, but when you start to realize the dimensions of what I talk about in the book, you realize that it was difficult for me not to write the book once I realized what was at stake. And I felt the American people and the people of the world, because it affects all of us, really had the right to know what has happened to us, because we're not being told by the mainstream media. And in fact, they're party to the hiding of all of it.
And you believe that cancer is caused by a virus, don't you?
Well, it's not a question of my believing it. It's today, well, for the second half of the 20th century, from 1960 to about 2000, that was the official position of the medical community, was cancer could not be caused by a virus. In fact, I have a document from the American Cancer Society that lists 200 possible causes of cancer, and the word virus is not even in there.
Good point. Ed, stay with us. We're going to be right back on Coast to Coast as we talk about Dr. Mary's monkey. Yes, we'll tell you about Dr. Mary as well when we come back. And you were talking about how the medical community had 200 some potential thoughts on cancer, but at no point did they mention viruses.
Yes, and before that, right before, that started in about 1960. In 1959, I have a copy of Time magazine from July of 1959, and the cover article on it talks about the new war on cancer through virus research and chemotherapy. And in that article, they talk about two of the women that play a big role in Dr. Mary's monkey. One is Sarah Stewart, who was the scientist who proved the existence of the cancer-causing virus in 1957. And the other one was Bernice Eddy, who we'll be talking about more later. And she was Stewart's research partner. And the two of them discussed the possibility, since they have proven way back in the 50s that viruses cause cancer, that there might be the possibility for a cancer vaccine. Now, we're sitting here in 2010, and the pharmas are marketing the HPV vaccine, which is the human papillomavirus. So they can no longer say that viruses don't cause cancer, because they're out there marketing a vaccine to stop a cancer-causing virus. So they've run out of excuses now. And when I started talking about this story back in 1995, I was way out on a limb by myself talking about cancer-causing viruses. But here we are 15 years later, and the scientific community has finally come around.
Who is Mary, Dr. Mary's monkey? Who is Mary?
Well, Mary is Dr. Mary Sherman. She was from the Midwest originally, from Illinois. And she went to the University of Chicago Medical School. And for those who are not familiar with that, that's a big powerhouse owned by the Rockefellers. It's every bit as prestigious as Stanford or Harvard or any of those other places, but it's a little bit lower profile, because it tends to really involve the Nobel Prize level scientists more than the football teams or the student body.
Sure. And it's, you know, and it's in the Midwest, Ed, where I am right now, and generally colleges, and there's some darn good ones, Washington University being one of them here in St. Louis. It's you're right, they're low key. They don't have that Ivy League feel to it at all, and so people kind of brush over it. It's one of the great medical schools in our country.
Yes, and Mary Sherman was from there, and some of the things that are unusual about her is, first of all, she was officially an orthopedic surgeon, which is a bone doctor, which my father was also. My father tended to be more of the surgeon, the guy in the operating room with the scalpel. She, however, was more of a pathologist. She studied the nature of disease itself. In fact, she was the chairman or chairperson, whatever you call it nowadays, of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. And the other thing about her was she was a world-class expert in the use of radiation, and she is published in that area, and I have a list of her articles presented in Dr. Mary's Monkey. The point about this, at the University of Chicago at the time, we find people like Enrico Fermi, who did the first sustained nuclear reaction, and Harold Urey, who was in charge of the Manhattan Project during World War II. I mean, they have the biggest brains in the country in radiation at the University of Chicago right at the time that she is there studying radiation and writing articles about it for the medical community. And then in 1952, she gets an invitation to come to New Orleans. And why someone would give up Chicago and all that for New Orleans, I think there were some personal things going on in Mary's life, which we can talk about later. But she comes down to New Orleans. She has a very attractive package. She is given a position on the faculty of Tulane Medical School, which at the time was one of the top medical schools in the country. She's runs a cancer laboratory for Dr. Alton Ochsner at the Ochsner Clinic, and that's one of the big regional medical clinics, kind of like the Mayo Clinic. And she, of course, gets a nice medical practice with that. So that's when she comes down to New Orleans. And because she's on the faculty to a medical school in the same department with my father and her are very good friends. So that's a real connection. She actually comes out to the house one night. She had to entertain the president of the Royal Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons when he was touring the United States. And frankly, she wanted another male at the dinner table who could talk to the guy about old war stories and stuff. Sure. So she brought my father along, and they came over to the house after dinner to continue a conversation that, frankly, they didn't want to have in the restaurant where other people might overhear them. And so they were very close friends. And when Mary Sherman was murdered, it was a kind of a big event in my family because she was one of my father's best friends. And the fact that it was a front page murder for 2 weeks in New Orleans, a very bizarre mystery that nobody seemed to be able to figure out.
And tell us, Ed, a little bit about this murder, if you would.
Well, there's like two sides to the coin. There's what the public was told and what I found out really happened.
Tell us what the public was told first.
Okay. The public was told that an intruder went into Mary Sherman's apartment, stabbed her to death, and set her on fire. And her body was found naked in the smoldering apartment, and they went around looking for a psychopathic sex slasher. And that was the public story, and everybody kind of wanted to take two steps back and say, oh, yeah, I met her once, but I didn't really know her, you know, that kind of stuff. And 30 years or so, about 28 years after her murder, which was in 1964, I actually got her autopsy report and police report out of the public library, and they had been locked in the chief of police desk in the intervening 28 years.
In his desk?
In his desk, yeah. And in fact, at one point, I asked a guy who was a professional murder investigator for Orleans Parish. I mean, that was his job. He worked for the DA's office.
Yeah.
I asked him if he could get me a copy of the police report on that. He said, oh, sure, no problem. I do it all the time. I'll get it for you, 48 hours. And when I called him back in 48 hours, he said, what did you get me into? He said, I almost got fired over this, and I've been answering questions. And when I tell him some teenage kid asked me to get this, they all laugh at me. He said, what is going on with this murder? And when I finally, I mean, nobody knew was the problem. When I finally got a hold of the autopsy report, I discovered that, yes, Mary Sherman had been stabbed, but there's a lot of situational stuff here. The real issue was that her entire right arm and right rib cage had been disintegrated by heat. Now, she's in a wood frame building. There's curtains next to her bed that didn't catch on fire. There's a paper label on the sherry bottle that didn't catch on fire. There's human hair next to this carbonized burn, and you can see into her body and see her organs. I mean, this is all in the official documents, and this is what was not told to the press. I mean, this is like saying, forgetting to tell the press that Nicole Simpson's throat got cut. You know, I mean, it's the major fact in the case.
Now, was anybody ever arrested or convicted?
No. No, the police stood up and said, well, you know, this is one we're not going to be able to solve, so everybody back to work, you know? I mean, they officially did that 2 weeks after the murder. And that's when the files got locked up and nobody was there. And everybody in town, I mean, the rumor mill was going crazy. And, of course, you have to realize my mother is married to my father, and my father works at the medical school where Mary teaches. So the whole rumor mill down in the medical school, the grapevine down there, is going nuts about what's going on. And they keep talking about the burglar alarm to Mary's apartment was turned off, all right? This was not a burglary, okay? And so they all think she knew her assailant. And what I finally figured out, I said, okay, what burned off her arm? The toaster? Yeah. I mean, there's nothing in her apartment that could do that damage to her body. So you're logically left with the inescapable point that whatever happened to Mary Sherman's right arm and ribcage did not happen in her apartment. Therefore, you're looking at a situation where somebody threw a body in a body bag, brought it back to her apartment, and faked a murder scene.
Now, why would they disintegrate her arm? What's the purpose of that?
Let's start with the what disintegrated the arm issue.
Okay.
Because the only way you can do that is like with millions of volts of electricity. I mean, we're talking about a lightning strike here. It doesn't even do damage like that. So we're talking about something that's, I'm going to call an industrial accident for the moment, involving a massively powerful piece of electronic equipment that Mary obviously had access to, and she obviously grabbed something with her right hand, and it blew out her arm like it was a spark plug or a fuse.
Okay.
And when I discussed this with doctors, and I've had a lot of people help me with this on the way, and one of these doctors had a lot of experience with high voltage burns, and he said, you know, Ed, what I can't figure out reading this autopsy report is why her feet didn't come off. I mean, normally the electricity goes to the ground. He said, here, her arm is gone, but her feet are fine. So what's going on? Well, I mean, it took me years to sort all this out, but we finally found the building that the equipment was in, and it had a steel wall in it. Why did it have a steel wall in it? To protect the operators from the radiation. They had a 5 million volt linear particle accelerator hidden in uptown New Orleans on U.S. government property, and this metal wall had a cable attaching it to the ground so that electrons and stuff would be routed to the ground, and she was standing in front of the wall when she grabbed the circuit breaker switch, and somebody, in my opinion, booby-trapped that facility. Now, when did this happen? Why did they booby-trap it? Let's look at this. The date is July 21st, 1964.
Okay, so it's after the Kennedy assassination.
Right, but it's the day the Warren Commission starts their investigation in New Orleans.
This is interesting. Okay, and you're going to be tying this together.
Oh, yeah.
It's a bizarre story.
It all fits like a puzzle.
Okay, so she's in there working. Are you saying that this burn was a radiation burn on her?
It was electrical. Now irradiation's electrical. I think what happened, I mean, I've talked to technical people, and some people think it could be a radiation burn. I think what happened is there was just so much electricity required to run this linear particle accelerator, and somebody wanted to expose the location of this laboratory, so they booby-trapped it. And she went in there, and when she flipped on the switch, all that electricity of 5 million volts all came back into her hand. And she was standing in front of the steel wall, and you're talking about a flashbulb of violence here. But what didn't happen was the electricity did not cross her heart.
All right, so she's not dead. She's in horrible pain, but she's still alive at this point.
She's
right?
Still alive. Her heart is still beating. Her right arm is gone. Her rib cage is gone. You can see her lungs and liver, and somebody is there with her. And they take a very slim, very precise instrument, only about a quarter inch wide, and they lift her left breast and they poke this instrument between her fifth and sixth rib cage into her heart.
Why did they decide to kill her?
Well, she's blind, she's maimed, she will never recover, And the clock is running. They've got to get her out of there.
And how do they explain what happened to her?
They don't. I mean, this is a secret.
No, that's the point. They have to do her in, I guess.
That's right. And, I understand your question now. The rhetorical, how do they explain it?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a mercy killing at that point in time. And then she's at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. Okay, there's about 13 buildings on this campus, and she's in one of the buildings on the back. Today, it's very interesting. I've been to this building recently. It looks like a set from a horror movie. Okay, the other 12 buildings on this facility, which is now run by the state of Louisiana as a hospital, are in perfect condition. The buildings themselves were all built back around 1910 or so. They're all brick and stuff. But this one building that the particle accelerator was in, the roof is caving in, the shutters are falling off. You wouldn't even want to walk into it. And I've talked to people who've been in the building because they were looking at renting it for a laboratory and stuff. And they just said it's in deplorable situation. But what you find in there is you find that there's a room down in the bottom that's like circular shape. And right in the center of that room, it kind of looks like an operating room, but everything is asbestos. The walls, the ceiling, the floor, everything is asbestos. And what they had in there was they had a platinum pyramid to divide the beam of the linear particle accelerator because they were reflecting equal doses into these chambers because there is a series of chambers around this room, and that's where they were putting the monkey viruses. And they were deliberately...
Yeah, let's jump ahead for a second, Ed, only because there's this tie-in where you write in your book, Dr. Mary's Monkey. Can I read a part here?
Yeah, please.
It says, it unveils the contamination of hundreds of millions of doses of the polio vaccine with dozens of monkey viruses. It spotlights the epidemic of soft tissue cancers that swept our country, and it exposes dangerous secret experiments which used radiation to mutate cancer causing monkey viruses. Now, are you saying that this was going on in this Frankenstein-looking building and Dr. Mary Sherman was part of it?
The third of the 3 points, yes. But in order to understand this, and I want to think about this from your listener's point of view at this point, what's causing all this? Where is this coming from? Why is this an issue? Why were they doing this? This whole thing goes back to the polio vaccine of the 1950s. And you were talking about the car industry earlier. They make about 30 million cars a year. These people had to make 200 million doses of the polio vaccine. Didn't have to, but that's what they were assigned to do. And in order to do that, they grew the polio virus to make the vaccines. They grew the polio virus on monkey kidney cells from the rhesus monkey. And that was the method of production. And this has to do with all this science that doesn't get much publicity, but it's all going on in the background. And after they released the 200 million doses of the polio vaccine in 1955 through 57, after they had done that, that is when they discovered the cancer-causing virus, originally named polyoma. This was discovered by Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy at the National Institute of Health in 1957. And by 1959, they had confirmed that the cancer-causing virus was in the polio vaccine.
So in this mystery, as we're unraveling tonight, Ed, we talk about this local murder in New Orleans of this doctor, and you're connecting it to what could very well be one of the biggest medical issues of mankind.
Yes, this is the biggest mistake in the history of government. I mean, they mass inoculated the entire American population and then some with a cancer-causing virus. And when I read this, and this doctor, I used to talk to him a couple times a week, and he really beat me up to find this book, and I finally found this book, and it was called The Health Century, written by Edward Shorter, who is a professor of medical history up at the University of Toronto, and the book had been used as the basis of the PBS series called The Health Century, and he had a chapter on this discovery of the cancer-causing virus. And then I said, I've got to get the statistics on this from NCI and see if this is real.
Now, let's get to the second point when we come back, Ed, and you won't believe this one. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast, where with Ed Haslam as we talk about this incredible story that he has condensed into his book, Dr. Mary's Monkey. Let's talk about point number two here, where you talk about an epidemic of soft tissue cancer. What is that?
Well, before the break, I was talking about this book, The Health Century, where Edward Shorter wrote about Bernice Eddy, who is the scientist who was working with Sarah Stewart when they discovered the cancer-causing virus. Well, Bernice Eddy went public with her information as best she could. She went to the Cancer Society meeting up in New York and announced that they had found a cancer-causing virus in the cells upon which the vaccine had been grown. She stopped short of saying it was in the vaccine, but she wanted to get her medical professionals looking into it, which some of them started to do. And we find up in Philadelphia, Maurice Hilleman, who was the head vaccine developer for Merck, became very tuned into this. In fact, I have a video of him on my website. I've got several hours worth of video on my website, drmarysmonkey.com, but you've got to spell out doctor. And Maurice Hilleman says very clearly that he found a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine. And he went to Albert Sabin, who was the developer of the sugar cube vaccine, as we know, and said, Albert, there's cancer in your vaccine. And so the insiders at NIH knew this way back in about 1958 or 59. So the question we need to get to here is, what did they do once they realized that there was they had already released 100 million doses of a contaminated vaccine, contaminated with a cancer-causing virus, and they still had another 100 million on the shelf? And for your listeners who aren't going to be able to stay with us for the next 4 hours or next 3 hours, I want to make sure they get this book if they want to. We have a very convenient 800 number, which is 556-2012, just the famous 2012 year. And there are operators standing by there that can take your order now, or you can get it from my website or from Amazon.com. Now, what we have here is when I heard about Bernice Eddy's announcement, I said, wait a second, she's trying to tell us something.
Mm-hmm.
Is she trying to tell us that there's an epidemic of cancer coming? And did it ever get here? And if it did, why didn't the press tell us? And so I went to a medical library, and I went and got together with the librarian, and I said, this is what I need to know. And she came back with a book of NCI statistics, and she said, it's on this page right here. And it was 16 years of every cancer that they had tracked.
Every
I went
cancer.
Home and put it on my computer, and the graphs are in my book. And what we see is a massive epidemic of soft tissue cancers that erupts in the years following the polio vaccine. And by soft tissue, I'm referring to breast as a soft tissue, prostate, lymphoma, and melanoma, which is cancer of the skin. If the quid pro quo here, if the connection between the polio vaccine and this cancer epidemic is, as I suspect, which is causal, then we got back 15 cases of cancer for every one case of polio on an annualized basis.
Now, how many people were vaccinated, and at what point did this vaccination stop with the contaminated monkey virus in it?
Well, the really saddest part of this entire story is they knew what was going on in 1960. Certainly by 1961, they still had another 100 million doses on the shelf. And the problem was they didn't want to stand up in front of the congregation and say, we got bad news. We just gave 100 million people a cancer-causing virus. They kept it secret, and they continued knowingly to distribute a contaminated vaccine for all of 1961, 62, and 63.
Oh, my God.
The total number, according to the Boston Globe, where somebody did write a very nice article on this, is about 198 million. So we're just at about the 200 million that they could document that actually got the contaminated vaccine. The problem is it's sexually transferable. So we're talking about not only everybody that got the polio vaccine between 1955 and 1963, but everybody that ever had sex with any of them.
You are saying that this virus that could cause cancer is also sexually transmittable.
Right. Italian research on this is interesting because they found the SV40 virus, which is the one we're talking about here, in the semen of otherwise of 55% of the otherwise healthy Italian males.
Now, what percent of the people that have the virus in their system do you think come down with cancer?
It's about 1 in 200. It's the same ratio as occurs with the human papillomavirus. They've nailed this one down very good. They say 100% of cervical cancer is caused by HPV, but only 1 out of every 200 get the cancer.
Okay.
Well, that's 0.5%. There's 300 million people here in the United States. 0.5% is 1.5 million cases of cancer a year, and that's what we've got.
This is amazing. All right, so that's the second point here.
And you want to put some dollars on that in terms of treatment? You want to see what $50 billion a year looks like?
You stack it up. It's pretty high. All right, that's your second point. Now let's get back to this monkey virus itself. How did it get contaminated?
Well, the polio vaccine had to be grown on something, and it likes monkey kidney cells. So they cut out the kidneys of these rhesus monkeys, ground them up, put them in petri dishes, and grew the polio virus in there in order to make the vaccine. And in order to really follow this, I got to get into a little bit of detail about the polio vaccine itself. The names Salk and Sabin are in most people's memory. Now, Salk was the first guy, and he said, look, there's three flavors of polio. There's heavy, medium, and light, okay? And the only one that really kills and cripples is heavy. So what we're going to do is we're going to kill the heavy one. We're going to drown it in formaldehyde, and we're going to use that dead virus to trigger people's immune system. And so that is called the inactivated or dead virus vaccine, and that was what was launched in April of 1955.
All right.
And it
now, I was born in 1950. What do I have? What's in me?
Probably the next one. But let me finish up with this part of the story, because this is really important, the link here. There were six laboratories producing this Salk vaccine, and they had a big press conference up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, about the Francis trials, that said this thing was safe. And so they told the entire American public, this thing is safe. Roll up your sleeves. Get ready. Here comes the polio vaccine.
Yeah. Line up, folks. Right?
Line up. And at that point, they turned around and they handed it to Bernice Eddy, who was the official vaccine safety tester for the National Institute of Health, and said, approve this. And she took it and injected it into her monkeys, and she got back dead and crippled monkeys. And she took photos of it and said, if you release this, you're going to kill children. Okay? So you ought to delay this thing until we can figure out what the problem is. And they said, are you nuts? We've already told the public it's safe. We can't tell them there's a problem with it at this point. And they called Dr. Ochsner down in New Orleans. Now, Dr. Ochsner happens to be like one of the major stockholders, if not the major stockholder, of the Qatar Laboratories that's producing the vaccine.
Oh, geez.
And they said, you know,
sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Doc, we got a problem here, and it's not with the other five labs, it's with Qatar, okay? And we need you to withdraw your vaccine quietly. And he said, I'm not doing that. He said, this vaccine's safe. I've known Jonas Salk for 20 years. I've been following this thing every step of the way. And so what he does, he's head of surgery at Tulane Medical School.
Now, did he actually believe that it was safe? Or what was he just saying?
What is actually believed? He calls the entire faculty of Tulane Medical School together in an amphitheater and brings in his own grandson and granddaughter. And says, I would never ask you to do anything I would not do here. I'm going to inoculate my kids right here, right now. And within 48 hours, his grandson was dead and his granddaughter had polio.
Oh, my God. All right. What was the fallout after that with him?
Well, the first thing they did was they withdrew the Salk vaccine. Salk lived out his life on the bluffs of Santa Barbara. He's got the greatest PR organization in the world. And he got an award from President Eisenhower on the lawn of the White House. But people forget that his vaccine backfired on launch and was withdrawn. And what they did, they turned to another vaccine developer, Albert Sabin, and they said, what would you do? And he said, well, you got these three flavors, heavy, medium, and light. Just use light. Because it really doesn't do anything except give you like flu-like symptoms, and it doesn't kill or maim. So they deliberately left polio light alive. It's called the live virus vaccine. In the polio vaccine, they grew it on monkey kidney cells, and they started out injecting it with a syringe into the veins. And after a while, they figured out they could just put a couple of drops of monkey viruses into a sugar cube. And you, to answer your question, probably got the sugar cube just because of your age.
Probably did, if I remember.
And the little white cup stacked up on the school cafeteria tables where we were all. In fact, I remember standing in line with those little white cups and the sugar cubes in there, and I saw the kids in line, and I'm in New Orleans at the time, pocket the sugar cube. And I said, what are you doing? He said, it's all full of monkey pus. I'm not taking that thing.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit more about Bernice Eddy. So she says, don't give this out. Don't do this. Did she have any clout to stop it?
No, because the people she reported to refused to do it. Now, all those people were fired, okay? When heads rolled everywhere, the head of National Institute of Health was fired. An entire group of people handling this thing were fired. And Eisenhower's president at this time, and he turns to Nixon and says, you get this thing back on track. We promised these people a vaccine to stop this epidemic. And you got to remember this. This goes back to FDR, okay, who had polio and the March of Dimes. And there was like a media hysteria about polio. And it was, polio is a bad disease. And they had the iron lungs and all this other stuff going on. And there were about 35,000 cases a year that translates to 125 kids a day getting polio. So there was a lot of urgency on this.
Proponents, Ed, of the vaccine still say that it eradicated polio. Not true?
I'm going to leave that to others. I've read a lot of stuff that said the disease was on the decline in the first place.
And would have gone away by itself.
Right. And I have some other views on that. But, as you know, I'm not a doctor, and I need to respect that there's certain edges of things that I don't want to talk about on the radio.
Fair enough. Okay, so let's we've got this epidemic. You believe through your investigation it's based on this contaminated monkey virus that is in millions of doses. And now you're saying they finally pulled it off the shelf, or what happened?
They pulled the first one off the shelf. That was the Salk vaccine. Then they came back in 1956-57 with the Sabin vaccine. And that is the one that got the bulk of the distribution. Most of that 200 million doses was Sabin's vaccine.
And that was contaminated.
Yes, but they didn't realize it until they had already released 100 million doses.
Oh, my God.
Now, at that point, they got to say, put yourself in their shoes. What do you do? Well, the first thing you do is you say, this is now a national security secret and nobody's allowed to talk about it because I don't want somebody chopping off my head, all right? The second thing you do is you say, let's get busy trying to figure out a solution. Now, what would be the solution? Well, the people involved, the people who discovered this are Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy, and we know from that Time magazine article that they believed that a vaccine was possible. Now, when you're looking at polio, you've got heavy, medium, and light, but you're looking at SV40 here, the virus that contaminated the polio vaccine, they only got one flavor of it, and it's bad. So if they can get that virus to mutate into a weaker form, then they can use that weaker form, just like Sabin did, as a vaccine. So how do you get a virus to mutate? How do you mutate something? Well, why don't we use radiation? We got this nice machine here called a linear particle accelerator, it will create a beam of radiation that we can just turn the dial and control the wavelength and strength of, and we're going to set this facility up. We don't want this up here in Bethesda because we don't want everybody poking their nose around on it. We're going to put this way down in New Orleans because we want it close to Dr. Ochsner, who is president of the American Cancer Society, and he's the guy that lost his grandson to the polio vaccine, and we want him to supervise this project. And so we're going to build this facility. We're going to set this facility up 0.5 mile from his personal residence.
And is that the one that Mary Stewart Sherman was working at?
Yes.
Okay.
That's where, that's where her arm got blown off.
All right. Okay. So they bombard this mutated virus. They mutate it. What happens to it?
Well, time frame, we're now in 1960-61, and I've tracked down people from Army Bioweapons who are, you know, working within 1 mile of the facility and stuff like this. They're trying to do this for the purpose of creating an anti-cancer vaccine. But right at that time, what happens? Fidel Castro takes over Cuba and moves Russian nuclear missiles into Cuba, and New Orleans is now within the range of the missiles. Now, I grew up in New Orleans, and I can tell you the hysteria of Cold War mentality that was alive and well in the city at the time, because that blockade, I mean, not the blockade, the embargo that we did on Cuba, which is still in place, cost New Orleans about 25% of its trade, which is like, you know, cutting 25% of cars out of Detroit or something. I mean, it was a big issue to the economy in New Orleans. And the threat of Castro was that he was going to take his revolution to the rest of Latin America and wipe out the rest of our trade. And now he's moving in Russian missiles with a 600-mile range, and we're 450 miles away from them. So, you know, the idea that Castro was a real problem to New Orleans was a very big idea. And what this is going on in the background. Meanwhile, they're roasting these monkey viruses with the radiation. And guess what? They're discovering that it's making the cancer more aggressive.
It's not killing it. It's not slowing down. It's becoming out of control, isn't it?
More aggressive. And they say, well, you know, if we promised, the government of the United States promised the Russians that we wouldn't go into Cuba as part of the deal with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So they start looking, and this is very well documented, they started looking for alternative ways to kill Fidel Castro. I mean, we've all heard about the exploding cigars and
yes,
and those things. Well, one of the ways, which is documented in some books, about people like Sam Giancana and stuff, is that they were looking for an injectable cancer agent. And this is what's called the touchdown play that they wanted to do. And they were going to smuggle this into Cuba and have somebody give it to Castro. I personally think this is kind of a harebrained scheme, but the people at the time were very serious about this. And so they made the decision to weaponize the cancer. And by it continually, they set up a loop of laboratories across New Orleans. And these were all cellularized and secret facilities. And in order to do this, you have to have a lot of mice.
All right, hold on right there, Ed. We're going to come back and get more of this story. Then there's a tie-in with Lee Harvey Oswald and JFK as well. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And if you're just tuning in, we're with Edward Haslam, his work, Dr. Mary's Monkey. We're talking about the viruses and contamination. Now, you talk about that they decided to weaponize the cancer for a biological weapon. Let's pick that back up, Ed.
Right. We're now at the heart of this story, and this story obviously has a lot of moving parts to it, and it's a lot for a radio interview, but I'm happy to talk about it on the radio. But I did write a 374-page book that's very well documented that supports all this, and that's what Dr. Mary's Monkey is, and you can get it at 1-800-556-2012. Now, the point is, we've talked about the Russian missiles coming into Cuba. We've talked about why they had this linear particle accelerator set up on this secret facility in New Orleans, which is a U.S. Public Health Service hospital, which is a campus guarded by U.S. Marines. And this is in a building on the back of the campus that nobody really has a need to go to. And it's labeled the Infectious Disease Laboratory, just to keep out the casual traffic. And that is where they're doing the radiation. But what they are doing is they're taking these viruses and they're injecting them into mice to grow tumors. And this is a very common medical research practice. Mm-hmm. But it takes a lot of mice. And so they have to set up a facility where they've got 2,000 mice in cages. And because this is secret work, this is buried in a safe house in New Orleans. And one of the things I found was the location of the safe house, which has happened to be across the street from the residence of David Ferry, who was arrested by District Attorney Jim Garrison.
That's right.
Within 48 hours of the Kennedy assassination. And when his investigators went through Ferry's apartment, they found a treatise on using cancer-causing viruses to induce cancer. That was found in Ferry's apartment. It's in the National Archives today. I have a copy of that treatise in my book. Okay, it is very real, but David Ferry did not write it. That treatise was developed up at the National Cancer Institute, probably by Sarah Stewart, for reasons I explained in the book. So what they're doing is they set up this facility where the mice live. They've got a facility across the street at David Ferry's apartment where they take the mice, kill them, cut out the tumors, grind them up in a blender, make some microscope slides, put them back in the test tubes. They take all this back to a doctor to review. Then they take it all back to the U.S. Public Health Service for another round of radiation that ratchets up the lethality of the virus.
Okay.
And they do this as a loop. Now, in order to do this, you've got to have someone to handle the cancer-causing viruses. This is very technical and very dangerous work. And you don't really want somebody well-known to do this. You want somebody that's untraceable to do it, because if you get caught, you want to say, oh, that's ridiculous. They couldn't be doing that. And they actually have this girl in Florida, who's very interesting, because when she was junior high school, she watched her grandmother die of cancer, and she decided to dedicate her life to finding a cure.
Okay.
And in high school, she starts doing her own cancer experiments. The thing is, she's got support from really sophisticated people in this, and by the time she's a senior in high school, she is giving cancer to mice in 7 days. This is faster than they're able to do it at the National Cancer Institute.
Was she a girl genius?
I think you'd have to. She was certainly dedicated. She's very, very bright. People use terms like that for those kind of people. So,
yeah.
But the point is, just luck and fate, the American Cancer Society turns out to have a meeting in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is the next town over from where this gal lives, and she goes and crashes the party and meets the VP of research for the American Cancer Society and shows him her research. And they now realize that they have a teenage girl working in a dirt floor laboratory in a high school that's outperforming the National Cancer Institute.
With no budget.
Yes. And they say, honey, you're coming with us. But before they do, this doctor in St. Petersburg, I mean, who's really from somewhere else, he's from New York, and he used to be the dean of the medical school at the University of Minnesota. His name is Deal. He picks up the phone and he calls his buddy Alton Ochsner, former president of the American Cancer Society. Said, Alton, you got to get down here. I want to introduce you to this girl. And Ochsner goes down there and brings a third guy with him. And the three of them go with Judy back to her high school and look at her laboratory. And they say, oh, this is really amazing. And this part is in Judy's new book, not in Dr. Mary's Monkey, but it's all connected. They say, we got two things to tell you. One is we're shutting down your laboratory today. You got no idea how dangerous this is.
And right. So they have the grounds to do that.
Yes, and you're dealing with immensely powerful people like the president of the American Cancer Society and his buddy that he brought along with him, who was Harold Urey, who was in charge of the Manhattan Project during World War II.
So they had some heavy hitters.
Heavy hitters, and they say, this is so dangerous, you can't even believe what you're doing. You're playing with fire. We're shutting it down. But you, young lady, are coming with us, basically. I mean, we're going to train you, because we see you as a weapon in the war against cancer. And they set her up to go up to Buffalo, New York, to the Roswell Park Cancer Institute up there, where she is trained to handle cancer-causing monkey viruses. At this point, you realize that the leadership of the cancer establishment are all aware of the contamination of the polio vaccine. And they got some real serious questions about it. And they like the fact that they have this girl prodigy who is capable of doing all this advanced and sophisticated research that does not have any degrees, is even a minor at this time, and nobody knows who she is. So these guys can conduct research that they don't want to tell anybody they're doing and get the answers to it so they can figure out what's going on with this cancer stuff. And so she's at the University of Florida in 1963. She gets a phone call from Dr. Ochsner in the spring of this. And Ochsner says, well, how would you like to skip the last 2 years of medical school? The last 2 years of college and start medical school in the fall. By the way, we'll pay your tuition and give you room and board and a stipend. We just have a little project we need you to do this summer. And by the way, you'll be working under the wing of that hotshot cancer researcher from Chicago that's on my staff, Mary Sherman. Would you like to do this, Judy?
And, of course, Judy jumped at it.
Judy jumped at it. It's her dream job, okay? So on April 19th, 1963, Judy gets on a bus in Gainesville, Florida, and she heads to New Orleans for the summer. And what her job is she is the one that is to kill the mice, cut out the tumors, grind them up, prepare the test tubes and the slides, and do all this in a clean sort of situation, but all in secret. And this work is all done in the kitchen of David Ferry.
In his kitchen?
In his kitchen.
Now, is she still convinced that she's trying to cure cancer and do something for the good of mankind?
Well, for the good of mankind. See, when she gets there, she gets informed that Castro has these nuclear missiles and he's trying to start World War III. So in order to stop World War III, they really need to figure out how to weaponize this cancer so somebody can take out Castro and prevent World War III. This is the line that she is fed there.
It's the old patriarch, you know, make her feel patriotic, right?
That's right. And they've been doing it all along with her, and she's been signing loyalty oaths, and the military has been supplying her. We got letters from Walter Reed and all this stuff to her saying, here are the chemicals and all this stuff. She is being supported by the most powerful people in the country in this, and by the military. And she's an asset. I mean, just like they say in the intelligence business, she's an asset. And she's now in New Orleans. They find her an apartment. They give her a cover job. And while she's on the clock at the cover job, two afternoons a week, she goes over to the secret laboratory to do this cancer work. And there's three things you can say about this gal. First of all, she's brilliant. Secondly, she's beautiful because we've got photos of her. And thirdly, she gets lost going around the corner. I mean, she's 19 years old, and she's naive, and she's from a small town in Florida, and she's in big, bad, sin-sick New Orleans. So what does she need? A babysitter, a bodyguard, somebody to make sure that she gets to where she's going, that she's here's the cover job. So they set her up with this ex-Marine.
Oh, no.
Who's at her elbow, who works with her at the Riley Coffee Company, and the name of the ex-Marine is Lee Oswald.
You've got to be kidding.
No, I'm not. I'm saying this is what is unknown about Oswald, and when you realize this, they're not going to let this guy get into a courtroom and start talking.
This is bizarre. Okay, so Oswald is her bodyguard, basically.
Essentially. Her escort, yeah.
Now, at that point,
they both live along. Oswald gets her an apartment, okay, right off of Magazine Street. Oswald lives on Magazine Street, and the magazine bus goes from Oswald's house, picks up Judy, and drops them off in front of the Riley Coffee Company where they both work. Now, William Riley is probably the biggest anti-communist in New Orleans. Why? Because he imports coffee from South America. And if this communist revolution gets into these countries that he buys his coffee from, he's going to lose his free labor, you know?
Right.
It's a real threat to him. And the other guy that's the biggest anti-communist in New Orleans at the time is this Dr. Alton Ochsner. And Ochsner sets up this organization called the Information Council for the Americas, or INCA for short. And Riley is one of the founding members of this and one of the main financial contributors to it, as are some other very interesting people like Farley from California, who owns Schick and Technicolor and stuff. And so you've got some very powerful people financing this political action group in New Orleans, which is founded and organized by a doctor. Now, I get involved with all this, and I wound up going down to New Orleans in 1993, I think it was, because I had seen something really strange back in the 80s. Somebody had shown me some files that they said were secret files, and they wanted me to do some work on them. Well, these files, I was told in 1982, belonged to Guy Bannister.
And he was also down in New Orleans at the time.
Yeah, well,
right?
he's the former head of the FBI in Chicago, who everyone who studies this says is running Oswald. He's Oswald's boss.
Absolutely.
In New Orleans.
He had a little office up there and everything.
And so I'm shown these files, and I wind up working with somebody who's investigating this for PBS, and we go down there and we find the files, thanks to a lead from Jim DiEugenio, in INCA. Okay, Bannister's files are in INCA. Okay, now you get the masthead of INCA, and you look at all the names on the masthead, and you find really interesting things, like the guy that's the head of security for INCA is the president of the retired special agents of the FBI. And then you discover over at Riley Coffee Company that the guy that Judy's working for, her boss, is an ex-FBI agent. And this guy knows all about Oswald. But he testifies to the Warren Commission, gives them information on Oswald and stuff, never mentions the fact that his secretary showed up at the front door of the coffee company day after day after day with Oswald at her elbow.
All right, so all this is going on, let's jump ahead a little bit. She's working with Mary Sherman, the doctor, and then Mary gets electrocuted, right?
Yeah, Mary's part of this underground medical laboratory, and after Judy gets the mice tumors ground up, she puts them in a thing, and it's a short bus ride over to Mary Sherman's apartment. She brings them over to Mary Sherman for her to look at. Mary's got a microscope and stuff in her apartment, and she's got access to an electron microscope through Ochsner in uptown New Orleans. And so she's doing the serious science study on this, and she's the one who's taking these vials of cancer-causing monkey viruses back to the U.S. Public Health Service hospital and re-exposing them to the next round of radiation, which is why she's in contact with this machine that blows off her arm.
Okay, now, what does this Judy do at this point when Mary dies?
Well, Mary dies in 64. That's after the assassination.
Okay.
What happens this summer is that they're working on this biological weapon, and it's killing the mice like crazy. And they say, well, let's take it up the ladder. Let's inject it into monkeys. And it starts killing the monkeys. And they say, well, that's great. You know, we're getting real close here. All we got to do is find out if this will kill a human, like a Cuban.
So they're really not too concerned about eradicating cancer. They're more concerned at this point with making a little weapon.
That's right.
Okay.
An untraceable weapon, because the public has been told viruses can't cause cancer.
Right.
So what a great weapon to have. I mean, imagine you've got a witness in a jail, and he knows something that you don't want him to tell the court, and you can get him to die of cancer suddenly.
Is this a fast-spreading cancer, Ed?
28 days.
28 days, you're gone.
Yep.
Okay.
And they know this number because they set up an experiment to test it on humans. We're talking about lethal experiments where the objective of the test is to kill the human. Okay? And they set this up in the mental hospital in Jackson, Louisiana, and they bring prisoners over from Angola, which is the infamous penitentiary up there in Louisiana, and these are, quote, supposed to be volunteers, and they bring them over there, they inject them with the stuff, and they watch them die. And when Judy realizes that, you know, her dream was to cure cancer. I mean, her motive was her dead grandmother. She's not in this to kill humans. And when she realizes that what she has gotten herself into, she protests and she bolts, okay? And at that point in time, they tell her, they say, first of all, you're lucky to be alive. And if you open your mouth, you won't be.
So now she sees a different
face. You're now out of medicine.
Yeah, she sees a different face with these people, doesn't she?
That's right, but they tell her she's out of medicine. And so what you've got is you've got this girl who's got, I mean, newspaper article after newspaper article, all these correspondences, all this documentation that she is the brain that's going to cure cancer. And she's doing all this stuff, and all of a sudden she hits New Orleans in 1963, and she never does anything in science again. What happened?
What happened? Is she alive now?
Yeah, she is.
Are you in touch with her still?
Yeah. Yeah, I do emails with her all the time. She's out in cyberspace in Europe somewhere.
What happened with Oswald at that point?
Oswald is very aware that he's being manipulated. And by the end of the summer, realizes that they're going after Kennedy and they're going to set him up, because all the stuff is that he's being asked to do in New Orleans is painting him as a fanatic.
Okay, what I want to do, Ed, when we come back in just a moment, is now tie in JFK to all of this and how it happens and why it happens. This is a remarkable story. Ed's book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, we'll get you that toll-free number again when we come back. It is available out there at Amazon.com as well. We'll be back. And welcome back. We're with Ed Haslam. We're talking about Dr. Mary's Monkey. How does all this, and I'm going to spend some time, Ed, talking with you about the cancer epidemic here, but how does this all turn into the JFK connection?
Well, let me just go for the jugular on that.
Let's do it.
We know that the former president of the American Cancer Society is the person that set up the media coverage of Lee Oswald's leafleting and stuff in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. We know this because he, the former president of the American Cancer Society, whose name is Dr. Alton Ochsner Sr., actually produced a record album of Oswald's radio debates, which said that he was responsible for it. And I've got a copy of that here in the house, and that's in the book. And so there is a, you know, once you realize you've connected these two people, this lone nut thing just goes away. And then when you realize that what they're doing is they're trying to kill Castro, well, so much for the Commie Pinko thing. I mean, what they're trying to do is set up Oswald to look like he's doing that. And Oswald starts to get suspicious about all this. I mean, they're telling him, hey, we're going to smuggle you into Cuba, and you're going to deliver this bioweapon to our friendly doctors down there, and they're going to kill Castro and all this other stuff. But Oswald starts to realize that that's not really the target. Kennedy's the target. And that's where this whole thing leads. And George, I manage my own website, and just during the break, I put something up there for the Coast to Coast viewers that tonight and tonight only, they can get my book signed by me for less than they can get it on Amazon. So if they want to go to Dr. Mary's Monkey, and you spell it Dr., D-O-C-T-O-R, Mary's Monkey, they can get that there tonight for that special Coast to Coast price.
Okay. So why do they really want to get rid of Kennedy? I mean, is it, as we've always heard, the fact that he didn't go back into Cuba, he didn't give support to the Bay of Pigs, involvement with the mob, was it all this?
You know, Kennedy thought he was president, and he didn't have to listen to all these people, you know, and that's not the way this country works. There's power in this country, and if they put you in the White House, and if you don't do what they want to, they get rid of you. I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to. I mean, ultimately, you got to ask them what was in their mind. But to me, that's the logical conclusion on this, that Kennedy was messing with stuff that they didn't want him messing with. He was messing with the Federal Reserve. He was messing with civil rights. He was not supporting the war in Vietnam. In fact, he was getting ready to pull out. You know, the people that own all that stuff didn't like that.
Also, don't forget, he wanted to change the Federal Reserve system.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so all of that. You're messing with the deep vein of power in the most powerful country in the world. And when you do that, when you cross those people, they take you out, as Lee Oswald found out.
So what I find fascinating, the players involved in the monkey virus scandal, I'll call it a scandal, were the same players involved in the JFK assassination.
Well, there's some connection there. It takes a lot of analysis to figure out who did what, but there are connections there. And these people are all working together. Some of them were being lied to by other people. I mean, it's the way this game works. But it's Oswald was at the center of it, and he figured out before he went to Dallas that he was going to Dallas to be part of this. And he basically felt it was his job. He was working for somebody. Oswald's a plant, okay? And I get into this in the book in terms of how does this guy who supposedly defected to the Soviet Union get back in the United States with a get-out-of-jail-free card?
Yeah, exactly. And as you know, when Oswald was arrested for the assassination of JFK, he said he was a patsy.
That's right. And he asked for legal representation, which he never got.
But he was in Dallas, obviously. And do you think he was part of that assassination team at all?
He penetrated it. This part of the thing, which I kind of get into in Dr. Mary's Monkey, but the book Me and Lee, which Judy was in close contact with Lee by phone all the way up to the assassination. She talked to him on Wednesday night before the assassination on Friday, and he was telling her what he was dealing with. And all of that is in that Me and Lee book, which is why Jim Mars is writing the afterword, and I'm writing the foreword on it. So those are questions that we'll be happy to talk about once the book is released, but we're sort of under an agreement not to discuss the details.
I understand. Will it be dramatically different from what we already think we know?
I think it is. I think it's a breakthrough book that is just presenting a whole new view on this thing from somebody who was there, who was in personal contact with Lee on a daily basis. And, you know, he figured out by the end of July that this is where that was going.
All right. Now, Kennedy wasn't going to go public with the monkey virus situation, was he?
Well, I don't think he could.
Okay.
I mean, he inherited that situation. You know, one of the questions that this gets into is who knew what. And one of the things that I find most interesting is that when Richard Nixon, who was vice president during this whole disaster and who was officially
under Eisenhower.
Right. When he gets into office, in the first week in office, he declares war on cancer. And he takes these resources, these bioweapon resources that have been over at Fort Detrick, and he moves them over to the National Tumor Lab at NCI. That's an awfully interesting opening move for a presidency. It's like he's already spent a lot of time thinking about this.
Right. He knew something. He knew something indeed. Now, this let's spend some time now talking about cancer, and then we'll open up some phone calls later. This has been, you know, something that has raced through this world, raced through this country at a all-time high. You know, it's the reason for the death rates in this country. How much of it, in your opinion, Ed, you're not a doctor, is attributable to this contaminated monkey virus from the 50s?
A huge portion of it. And let me frame it this way. We all associate lung cancer with cigarettes at this point.
Right.
But when Dr. Alt Noschner was in medical school, he was woken up in the middle of the night to go down and observe an autopsy on a man who had lung cancer because it was said that it was so rare that he would probably not see another case in his medical career. I mean, that's how rare cancer used to be. And we have 300% more cancer than our grandparents did. And why? You know, and I think I can point to, just in the statistics, about 60% of our current epidemic. And the reason it's soft tissue is that all the various cells in the body do not reproduce at the same rate. The things that reproduce the fastest, one is the brain cells and the neuroglia, one is the skin cells, you know, the reproductive tissues, and the lymph system is cleaning out the entire body. So these are the cells that are turning over fastest. And because of that, they're more likely to hit that 1 in 200 number that I was talking about
now,
earlier.
You said it's sexually transmittable, but does it also transmit to the fetus? And does that baby carry it into their adult life, the cancer virus?
I have seen studies by MDs on this, which say they are finding it in second generation grandchildren of the polio vaccine recipients.
Oh my!
This SV40 thing.
So it carries on.
Yes, and the people who got it worse, frankly, were the people that got the syringe, because what happens there is you're injecting this thing straight into the blood supply.
Yes.
Okay, as opposed to the sugar cube, because your intestines and stuff provides a barrier there. And so you don't get as much of it. You don't get the same exact stuff. But the people that got the syringe, which are my brother and sister, both got cancer.
At what point? What onset in their life?
My sister's 40th birthday. So that she got it when she was about 10 plus 30 years of incubation, right there at 40. And my brother, his started showing up late 40s, early 50s. Yeah. He had skin cancer. She had breast cancer. It's the big problem. It's the, you know, elephant in the living room that nobody's talking about.
You know what? I don't even know if they have a polio vaccine anymore. Do they even need it?
Well, would they have it if they didn't need it? Probably. They do have one. They've recently switched back to this inactivated strategy, but they have better technology today than they had back then. You know, and then there's the whole issue of vaccines in the first place, which is like another show in itself. But they, I even have an article from the New York Times which says they were withdrawing the polio vaccine, this is back in the 60s, until a monkey virus could be removed from it. You know, it's not on page one. It's buried back in the thing. So you see these little chunks of evidence, but what you don't see is the media asking serious questions about this.
There were a lot of people who knew about this contamination problem, and they didn't say anything.
That's right. But this operation with the radiation in New Orleans was more like a medical Manhattan Project. I mean, that was a very tightly controlled group. And what we find, it's set up in 1960. We find Sarah Stewart, who's the person that discovers the cancer-causing virus. She suddenly, weird career move, she suddenly transfers from the National Cancer Institute over to the U.S. Public Health Service, which would put her in a position to be administratively in charge of this facility, meaning that
they bought her off.
She had the power to quarantine the city if something went wrong.
Right. This could be one of the biggest scandal stories I've ever heard, Ed.
Well, I think it is. I can't imagine anything bigger. You know, I mean, this affects the health and safety of everybody. And it's a story that's so bad, frankly, that a lot of people don't even want to go there.
And then even now, though, you know, we hear about this situation with the H1N1 virus and the vaccine and the fact that, you know, we've got hundreds of millions of doses on the shelf. They're going to expire. You know, I said way before this was even a major story and a major issue that this is not going to be a pandemic. It's all a bunch of bull, and, you know, I couldn't understand where with 15 cases worldwide, the World Health Organization was saying that this was going to be a pandemic. It just didn't look right to me.
That's right. And George, it's the exact same tactics they used on the polio thing.
I was going to say,
fear.
They haven't changed at all. They haven't stopped doing what they're doing. They've used that old playbook of creating the fear and just going for it. And I don't trust them with these kinds of vaccines anymore.
No, and you're not alone in that. I can't tell you the people that I talk to that just won't go near them.
Yeah. So what do you do beyond the book? What do you do to help publicize that? I mean, you're doing this national show with me now. This needs to get heard. This story needs to get out there.
Well, the thing that I think will get the story out there more than anything else would be a movie. And, you know, we're working on that. And, you know, the problem is movies are really expensive, and you got to get some of the same people you'd like to be pointing the finger at are involved in the money thing. So you got to be careful about all that. But we have the screenplay. We have the producers. We're in the process of trying to do that. And I think that will put it into a medium that the American people will be able to digest and respond to, the same way that Oliver Stone's JFK brought the JFK story to life and got all those documents released.
You know, I've always said on this program, Ed, that there are no coincidences. And when you look at the story of the Oswald connection here and Kennedy and everything else, this stuff just doesn't happen by chance.
Yeah, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. I'm all for that.
And did you not write in some of the interviews that you had been working on that there are some videos on your website, drmarysmonkey.com, that some of them, like, for example, you talk about an interview with a Dr. Edward Shorter, right?
Right. Shorter's interviewing Maurice Hilleman, the head of vaccine development for Merck. And Hilleman is just saying, hey, all our monkeys were hopelessly cross-contaminated. And the problem with the cross-contamination is this, that monkey they used for the polio virus is an Asian monkey, but it was put in cages with African monkeys, which carry another disease called SIV, which is the simian immunodeficiency virus. That is the direct ancestor
to AIDS.
HIV-1. So what we've got here is you got a test tube that's not only got this SV40 in it that you're trying to get to mutate, but it's going to wind up having SIV in it too. And when you start shooting subatomic particles near the speed of light through a test tube and start hitting DNA, I mean, it's like shooting a gun into a computer. You're going to change something. And
if no, go ahead.
And so what happens is, and this is all happening 1960, 61, and when AIDS comes out, I'm talking about pretty mainstream things like Scientific American. They publish a book called The Science of AIDS. And all the epidemiologists looking at this, they run their mathematical regressions back, and they say case one is 1960. And the moment they say that, you get all these weird medical articles coming out saying, oh, 1959. And now you got this ridiculous thing about the chimpanzees in the jungles in the 30s and stuff, which I can which we'll do in the next half hour. But the point is that the possibility that these people inadvertently mangled SIV and turned it into HIV while they were trying to develop a vaccine to stop SV40 is very realistic, very plausible, and in my opinion, ought to be on the list of possible causes of AIDS.
How did it get out? How did it get out into the public? On purpose or accidental?
Well, I don't actually have the answer to that, but I promise you the people involved in this thing are capable of releasing it. You know, the earliest cases we know of are Haiti. I mean, in terms of real cases where the scientists are able to go in there and with their PCR and say that is HIV-1. The oldest HIV-1 that they know of is 1976 in Haiti. And that's according to the Los Alamos database. So when you get these claims of, you know, HIV-1 in chimpanzees, you know, it helps to know that that chimpanzee happened to be in a government laboratory in 1982, you know. So, and I got all the names on this. I think your interest, your readers, your listeners, excuse me, would be.
Well, they're also readers, believe me, heavy readers.
Would be very interested in hearing more about this chimpanzee link because it's, in my opinion, a total cover story.
All right, well, we'll talk about that when we come back, Ed, and we'll also go into some phone call modes. We'll take calls for the remaining part of this half hour and also next hour as well. Once again, where do you get the book?
Well, if you want to get it on the telephone tonight, there are people ready to handle your call, and we're packaging it with Me and Lee, because the same publisher that sells both, and Me and Lee is the story of Oswald and Judy. And that's at 1-800-556-2012, and on my website, which is drmarysmonkey.com, but spell out doctor, I've got a special coast-to-coast thing that's $5 off that puts it down under the Amazon price for tonight. And, of course, you can always get it at either Amazon or any local bookstore can order it because it's in the catalog.
Well,
Dr. Mary's Monkey.
It's a good read. We'll be back in a moment. We'll talk about this chimpanzee story and phone calls now for the rest of the night on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Ed. Let's talk about the chimpanzee story in depth here before we go to calls, if you would.
Yeah, sure. In the there have been various stories promoted over the years to try to put the origin of AIDS back in the 1950s. One was the Manchester semen story in Manchester, England, and they finally discovered the DNA of two people in the sample. And that was discredited and officially withdrawn. They've been talking about this guy in Leopoldville in the Belgian Congo for ages. But if you study that, you realize that he probably had what's called LAV, which is lymphadenopathy-associated virus, which the French discovered at the Pasteur Institute. And each one of these stories, they come out with this big headline that's got like 1950s in it, and then you read the detail and it doesn't hold up. I mean, they're not even using the proper test to determine these things. So in the late 1990s, which is 3 years after I published my initial book, I was very interested to see a story that broke all across the newspapers and the media all around the world that said they had discovered the origin of HIV-1 in chimpanzees. And the first thing that catches my attention like that is that that's not the way a story is normally grows, okay? That usually means that somebody with a lot of power is releasing the story whenever you get it simultaneously like that.
Yes.
So I was very interested in this claim, and so I actually got the magazines and Time and those sorts of things, and I read this story, And it talked about this scientist at the University of Alabama. Her name was Beatrix Hahn, and she was a DNA specialist. And she held a press conference, very well attended, which said they had discovered HIV-1 in chimpanzee cells. Okay, very good. This happened to be 16 years after AIDS had shown up, and Harvard didn't catch this, Stanford didn't catch this, University of Chicago didn't catch this, National Cancer Institute didn't catch this. So why is this thing showing up here 16 years later at the University of Alabama? So I'm interested to find out where she got these chimpanzee cells from.
Mm-hmm.
She says, well, a friend of mine sent them to me from Alamogordo, New Mexico.
Oh.
That's the White Sands missile base, okay?
Yep.
And there's a – I used to live in New Mexico, and I happen to be fairly familiar with the primate lab in Alamogordo. It was run by a fellow by the name of Fred Coulson. And about a year before he died, Fred Coulson gave an interview with a local health magazine or something. And he's very defensive of what he's done with the animals over the years, and he doesn't buy into all this PETA stuff and all that. So what happens is he says, Coulson says in this interview I'm reading, that in 1982, the moment he heard about AIDS, he contacted people and said, I would like some of that blood so I can give it to my female chimpanzees to find out if this has passed between mother and child. Just so happens that the chimpanzee that Dr. Hahn's sample came from was a chimpanzee by the name of Marilyn, a female chimpanzee who died in Coulson's laboratory 2 years later in 1984. And he had her cells cryovac'd, and they were in a freezer or refrigerator in his office. And when he died, they cleaned out the refrigerator, and they said, oh, here are some chimpanzee cells. Let's send them down to Beatrix Hahn. And that's how she gets her sample of the chimpanzee. It's from an essentially government-financed laboratory that had been doing experiments with AIDS for over 2 years before that chimpanzee died. So finding HIV-1 in a chimpanzee in a government laboratory, particularly a military one, proves absolutely nothing about the origin of AIDS. But it's a very convenient answer for those who want to make you think it came out of the jungles of Africa. So they finance her, and she's over in the jungle of Africa, and her people are picking up chimpanzee poo on the trails and analyzing them and all this other stuff. And they haven't found HIV-1 over there. They found the cousin of it, which we've known all along was the ancestor.
Okay, what's going on at Plum Island, do you know?
No, I don't. Okay. I need to stick to what I know, and I don't know enough about that to talk about it on the radio.
All right. Well, let's take some calls here.
Okay.
Let's go to Texas City, Texas. Paulie, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Paulie.
Yes, hi. My gosh, aren't you a little bit afraid, you know, for your own safety, being, you know, blowing the lid off of something that could, you know, basically implicate just every phase and facet of any societal, you know, standard? I mean, what I'm thinking is the possibility of maybe, perhaps rebuilding those cells, you know, with nutrition or something. But do you know anything about any way that this could be taken care of?
Well, let me start with the fear part of that question. And I simply had to make a decision a long time ago whether I was going to talk about this in public or not. And I made the decision that the issue was too big. I mean, once I realized that we have a cancer epidemic today, and this is probably where it came from, that I made the decision that this was simply my job to do for America. I mean, some guys wound up on the beaches of Iwo Jima. I didn't do that. But this is my job, and I went past that go-no-go point back in the 1990s, and I will say I have not had a trace of trouble since then, but part of that is because of how I handle myself. On the what can we do about it issue, the best and maybe the only defense we have against any of this is our immune system.
Yes,
and
I would agree with that.
Take care of yourself.
Your father was a naval commander, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, I spent 9 years in the Navy myself. And did this story which, you know, you got some exposure because of him and his work. Were you driven because of, you know, his work as a medical doctor?
I think that's a part of it, but I think it's a fairly small part. You know, my personal contact with the story, I sat on Mary Sherman's lap as a child. Okay. I mean, this story is pretty close to me. I was not real anxious to get into such a dark story so close to my family. I mean, that to me, that was very nerve-wracking at the beginning of this. But one of the things is that my father's father was also a doctor, and he developed the original anthrax vaccine. And I have documents about that posted on my website. And one of the things he was very clear on, and my father communicated this to me, is the fact you're either a doctor or a soldier. You don't use medicine to kill. Okay? If you take that oath, that's it. And my father was very much in that camp. In fact, I think the reason that my father left the Navy, which was an organization that he thoroughly enjoyed being a, I mean, he was a commander at 29, George. Can you imagine what his career would have looked like after that?
Oh, my God. He would have been an admiral.
Of course. And so all of a sudden, he comes home one day and tells my mother, I'm out of the Navy. And this is 1946, 47, when they weren't letting doctors out. So what went on? You know, and we know the Navy was involved in all kind of nefarious bioweapon and chemical weapon research at the time. I think they just asked him to do something that he was unwilling to do because of the ethical thing. And so I will say that within my own family, there's a strong ethical tradition that says medicine is not used as a weapon. And so that's part of what I carry with me as I you know, get on national radio and talk to people about this.
Lewistown, Montana, it's Ted's turn on Coast to Coast. Ted, go ahead.
Hi. Very interesting show tonight. I flew for airlines and Air Force for 32 years as a professional pilot. And once I moved over to the airline part of it, the Airline Pilots Association ran studies on the pilots. And, of course, back then most of us were men because that's just who got hired coming out of the various services. And they found that the airline pilots only got one kind of cancer more than average, and that was melanoma because of the very bright light up at altitude. But on all the other ones, the cancer rates were 0.008 of what the normal guy on the ground would get, down to 5 zeros and an 8 for the number 10 cancer, which indicates that the radiation at altitude was killing the pathogen, which I think he pointed out was probably a virus. And it's amazing to me that medicine can't figure that out and a bunch of people flying airplanes can. I just don't understand where medicine is going, that they can't figure it out, unless it's just nothing more than a money-making proposition for the oncologists.
Well, I
don't know.
Ted, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It's a very interesting comment that you've made about the airline study. And, you know, I go back to Will Rogers, you know, like we have the best government money can buy. The pharma industry, I mean, my father eventually resigned from the American Medical Association because he considered them a bunch of pill pushers for the pharmacies. And that's part of the problem. And when you're dealing with, you know, what would you say is the average cost for chemotherapy for somebody? I'm going to put the number, say, at $200,000. Okay, you multiply that times 1.5 million cases a year, and you start to realize that the enormity of the economic force behind all of this. And you start to realize why all they want to talk about is cure. They don't want to talk about cause. I mean, I found an incredible story in the media once. I was so shocked by it, I went to the newspaper and sat down with the editor to talk to him about it. And they said, cancer rate not set in childhood. Well, what does that mean? That the vaccine you got is not causing your cancer? And what I found out when you read the detail of the article, again, the big print giveth and the little print taketh away, you know, what I found in the detail of it was this was a story of people born in Vietnam who went to Canada and had free health care, and less people died in Canada than in Vietnam. And they were skewing the headline in order to put it in this context that you don't have to worry about the vaccines. I mean, there's big money behind this, and I think big money has a lot to do with it. And when you get into who sat on what board of directors, you wind up the usual suspects. I mean, this place in Indiana, the big pharmacy in Indianapolis. Well, it turns out the Quails own it, and George W. Bush sat on the board of directors. You know, so there's a lot of overlap.
Is that Lilly?
Lilly? Eli Lilly. Yeah. Sorry, thank you. It's 4 o'clock in the morning where I am.
No, that's okay. Well, you know, when you talk about, you know, cause and effect, how many years? It was 44 years, I think. Jerry Lewis has been holding this telethon to try to battle muscular dystrophy. 44 years. And he has probably raised a couple billion dollars, I would guess, you know, or close to it. We still don't have a cure for muscular dystrophy. That's a lot of money that has gone into research every season. You know, he raises $60, $80 million. I'm sure there's more money flowing. That's a lot of money, Ed. And still no cure.
It's the issue of the sheriff catches the bad guys and he's no longer a hero, you know?
Next up, we go to Bradenton, Florida, east of the Rockies. Tony, good morning.
Hey, George. Another great show. Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
I just got two questions that I just want to clarify because it's so confusing, this webbing, to me. I'd just like your guest to reiterate what he said before. I just want to know, why was Mary killed and who killed her? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks again, George.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, you know, those are questions that nobody's got clear answers to, because unless you interviewed the person that killed her, you wouldn't know what their real motives were. The fact that she happened to die the morning that the Warren Commission started its investigation into Oswald, and you realize that she was connected to Oswald, that raises a lot of suspicions for people. I personally think that the laboratory was the target, not her, per se. And, for example, if Dr. Ochsner had been the one who walked in there and flipped the switch and his arm had been blown off, they wouldn't have been able to take him back to his apartment and call it a sex slashing, which is what they did to Mary Sherman, who was a widow from out of town without a family in the area.
She knew too much, yeah, didn't she?
Well, she certainly knew a lot. I mean, just like they wouldn't let Oswald into a courtroom, I don't think they wanted anybody asking Mary Sherman questions about all this. I'm not sure, you know, I mean, I'm more of the opinion that this was a battle over the White House, and the people were playing really serious games with their own private people doing this. But somebody tampered with and sabotaged the electrical wiring in that thing, which is why she got electrocuted. That's my take on it. And whether that was to shut her up over Oswald or whether that was to blow the – I mean, Oswald had a ID card on him made out to A.J. Heidel, which came from the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. This is the evidence that's laying on the table at the exact time that there is this incident at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital. I mean, does that not call your attention to it? And where is this place? It's a half a mile from Lee Oswald's apartment. It's a half a mile from Dr. Ochsner's house. It's about a mile from Mary Sherman's apartment. It's right in the center of all this.
It is too bizarre. What about witnesses to some of these events? Do you have good witnesses?
As far as I'm concerned, we do. Let me say that the original witness to this would have been Lee Oswald, and he was killed. And the next witness was Jack Ruby, and the odds, that one looks like he was injected with cancer to shut him up, too, because he was knowledgeable of this activity in New Orleans.
What happened to David Ferry?
I've had people who are professional pathologists tell me that David Ferry was murdered. The coroner said he died of natural causes. I think, given the timing on it, it looks like he was professionally silenced, meaning killed. But people could argue over that one. Officially, he was not murdered. Officially, it was natural causes. Judy, who's the girl who worked in the lab in David Ferry's apartment, is the primary witness at this point in time. And then the question that comes up from that is, well, was there anybody who knew, who saw Judy and Lee Oswald together? And yes, there is. And I have a video of her on my website, drmarysmonkey.com. And her name is Anna Lewis. And she was actually the wife of David Lewis, who worked for Guy Bannister. And they used to socialize with Lee and Judy. And they would, like, double date. And she talks about this on camera. And so there is another live witness to the witness that supports all this. There are other people that are alive that I don't want to get into their names because I'd like them to stay that way, who are very knowledgeable of this. And if the right person asks them the question, like, you know, before Congress, they might even get a straight answer out of them.
Did the Warren Commission ever ask or interview Judy?
No. That's why she's alive, basically. I mean, what's amazing is that it was Moynihan, who was Judy's boss at the Riley Coffee Company, who testifies to the Warren Commission but doesn't mention Judy. And the other thing is that Judy's signature is on Lee Oswald's time cards. So when the Warren Commission asked Moynihan about that, he gave the commission a list of the dates and times that Oswald clocked in and out, and the Riley Coffee Company gave the FBI Oswald's time cards. However, they didn't put it in the Warren Commission. Why not?
Exactly. We're going to take another final hour of phone calls with you, Ed, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. The story is Dr. Mary's Monkey. The author, Edward Haslam, will be back. Is this a CIA operation, Edward?
Well, it'd be a lot easier to answer if we knew what the CIA actually did. And you know, I mean, that's such a great question because most of the people who work for the CIA don't really have a full view of what it did. But the document that I find most interesting is something that popped up during the Watergate thing, when the current director of the CIA suddenly realized that he had gotten in front of national television and made a blatantly false statement about something the CIA had done. And he turned to his head of security and he said, I want you to find out what has been going on in this agency that could compromise us. And I want it in an eyes-only memo. And so the only people that even got to see this memo originally were the top three people at the CIA. And this memo, according to their language, was called the Family Jewels Memo. And in 2007, General Hayden was the CIA director, and he called a press conference, and he said, time to open the kimono. I'm going to show you all the secrets of the CIA by revealing the Family Jewels Memo. And the Family Jewels Memo had eight jewels in it. The only problem is they revealed number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. Jewel number one. And this memo covers a period of time that's exactly the period of time I'm talking about in New Orleans, like from 1958 to 1964. Jewel number one is 100% redacted to this day. The CIA did something 45 years ago, right at the time frame we're talking about, that is so compromising or embarrassing to them that they are unwilling to tell the American people even a single word about what they did. And so, you know, is this a CIA operation? Was Oswald CIA? Blah, blah, blah. Did the CIA use its money laundering facilities to finance the construction of the linear particle accelerator on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in New Orleans because they knew about the contamination of the polio vaccine? You know, these are questions that I wish I really had answers to, and one day we may. But as long as the CIA refuses to tell us anything about Jewel number one, I can't really answer that fully.
All right, let's go to the phones. Bill on our Skype line is in Honolulu in Hawaii. Go ahead, Bill. Bill, can you pick us up? Well, there will be no Bill on the Skype line now. Let's go to Bob in Falls City, Washington, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, George, I remember meeting you up in Falls City or up in Lake City book signing.
Yes.
And I had my prostate removed about 6 months before I met you. And I'm still alive and kicking after 4 years. But
good
the
for you,
question
Bob.
I have for your guest is I was in school during the time they used the children for guinea pigs. And my parents didn't sign me for a guinea pig. But after the shot was proved supposedly safe, I got the shot. Then when I was later in school, I got received the sugar cube. And then also when I was in the military, I received the sugar cube. Is this stuff accumulative, or is it just one dose gives you what you don't want?
Well, in immunity, which is ultimately what this is about, a numbers count is the phrase they use. The more of something that's in your system, the worse it is, if it's something that can attack you. And you're, I have a number of people who communicate with me who got polio from the polio vaccine, and some of them got it in trials that were done before the vaccine was officially released. So there's a really dark history to this whole thing. So when you make the statement about using children as guinea pigs, I, from my own experience in talking to people who were in that situation, have to say that's probably a pretty good description of it. And the shot was worse than the sugar cubes, just because it goes straight into the blood supply and you don't have a protection of your intestine there.
When you were putting the book together, did you come across any pitfalls there, anything that was problematic for you?
What do you mean by that?
Well, difficult moments.
For me personally?
No research or anything like that.
Well, the whole project is a brain buster. I mean, I remember the night I was trying to figure out what was going on in monkey virus research around the world. And I was still in Michigan at the time. I drove down to Ann Arbor, and I went to the medical library, and I spent about 5 or 6 hours going through their books there. And every time I opened up something, I mean, this is where I found that book, The Dangers of Handling Simians, that I write about in there, where they talk about, you know, doing that, messing around with monkey viruses could cause an altered pathogenesis, in other words, new disease, particularly with the exposure to radiation. And I tracked down the guy who said that. His name was Richard Fiennes. He was a part of the a zoo in London. He was their monkey guy at that. And so he was a primatologist, is what I'm trying to say, a monkey scientist. And he went to this meeting trying to warn everybody. He said, don't you see how dangerous this is? I mean, we're talking about the possibility of creating a new disease that we won't be able to stop. Okay? And they said, yeah, how much funding are we going to get for doing this? You know, Richard Fiennes was so disappointed by the response to his warning that he got out of monkey research. He went and lived up on the Arctic Circle and studied wolves for the rest of his life. You know, there's that night in particular, when I realized they were playing viral roulette with the population, was probably the hardest single night for me. And there were other things about Mary Sherman. You know, I didn't just jump to this conclusion of what happened to Mary Sherman. It took me a long time to sort out. But when I finally realized that I had the evidence to show that she was not murdered in her apartment and the whole thing was a cover-up, I mean, that was another brain buster of a moment.
You theorized the possibility that Oswald could have been working for Bobby Kennedy. Tell me about that.
Well, the question is, how did Oswald get back into the United States? And the point is that there were major American newspapers that reported that he had defected. And there were lots of people in the government who considered him a defector. And when you defect, you lose your citizenship. And as I started researching this, I realized that there's actually a very clear legal process to determine whether or not you're a citizen or not, whether or not you have lost your citizenship through a particular action. And the officer of the United States government who's capable of doing that, making that decision, making that determination, is the Attorney General. And at the moment Oswald returned to the United States, Bobby Kennedy was the Attorney General. And that got me thinking a lot about that. And then I realized that the real issue was that when Jack Kennedy came into office, the CIA was doing stuff they were unwilling to tell the White House they were doing. So what you've got there is you've got a question of, like, who's really running the government? Is it the president or is it the CIA? So he put his brother, Bobby, in an oversight capacity over the CIA to find out what they were doing. And when they got together with the controller, the head accountant for the CIA, they discovered they were missing tens of millions of dollars that were untraceable. So the question was, what were they doing with all this untraceable money? And Bobby needed to spy on the CIA. Now, normally, you just would have called up their FBI and had them do it, because on the org chart, that's the way it's supposed to look. But now J. Edgar Hoover was in the middle of blackmailing Jack Kennedy over the Judith Campbell situation. And they were sworn enemies. I mean, Hoover hated the Kennedys, and they hated him. And so they just couldn't call up J. Edgar and say, spy on the CIA for us. They had to get their own assets, their own professionally trained spies, and they had this guy in the Soviet Union who we had sent over there, frankly, who got marooned in the Bay of Pigs turnover. I mean, his sponsors got fired by Kennedy. So Oswald's saying, I want to get back in the United States. And they're saying, well, you know, we can let you back in, and we've got some stuff we'd like you to do. And the fact that Oswald was from a mafia family in New Orleans put him in position to spy on Carlos Marcello's organization for Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy was at war with the mafia, particularly with Carlos Marcello. It was so bad that Bobby had him kidnapped and put on an airplane and flown to Guatemala and dropped in Guatemala without a passport to see how he got back in. I mean, these are the kind of tactics that were being used. And Bobby Kennedy said, I'm going to use underworld tactics on the underworld. So, you know, I'm put forth the proposition, and it's really an idea that needs to be investigated more. But the idea that Oswald was reporting through somebody else but up to Bobby Kennedy, and he was spying on the mafia and the CIA for the Attorney General.
Was Jim Garrison aware of any of this, the district attorney at the time?
Well, you know, I don't think Garrison understood the dimensions of what he was getting into. It reminds me of the old Rocky and Bullwinkle thing where, you know, Rocky says, hey, Bullwinkle, watch him pull a rabbit out of his hat, and it turns out to be a bear or a lion or something.
Yeah,
I mean, it's kind of what Garrison thought. He was investigating the murder of the president, and he was, but he didn't realize the dimensions. I mean, one of the things is Bobby Kennedy sent people down to shut Garrison up. You know, why?
Yeah.
You know, because Bobby Kennedy wanted to deal with it his way, and there's a lot of reliable reports that says the moment that Bobby Kennedy, I mean, from people that were in the office with him, said the moment Bobby Kennedy was told that they had arrested Lee Oswald, he picked up the telephone, called McCone over at the CIA, and said, did your people kill my brother?
Unbelievable. What a story. Let's go back to Skype. Bill is in Honolulu. Go ahead, Bill. Oh, Bill.
It's a button problem.
There is no Bill. That's it for Bill. No more. Let's go to Granbury, Texas. Vincent, go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey, Vincent.
Hello.
Fascinating study you got going here. I'm a little perplexed by the Lee Harvey Oswald connection. Sounds kind of like Philip K. Dick and James Ellroy partying with Alex Jones, but I will leave that till I read the book. My question is, you're talking about a 300% spike in cancer rates since 60?
No, since our grandparents, and that's from USA Today, and that's from Deborah Davis, who was a public health service officer's comment.
Okay. Does that correlate with the rest of the world, or is it just in America? And if it is worldwide, how many other nations were using our vaccine? That's my question. I'll take the answer off the air.
Good question. Go ahead.
The data that I have access to is mostly American data. There are comments from Maurice Hilleman, whose video is on my website, where they're actually joking about the Americans winning the Olympics because the Russian athletes are so weighed down by tumors from the polio vaccine that they won't be able to compete. What's interesting is the Scandinavians, meaning Norway and Sweden and such, looked at our polio vaccine and rejected it. And they said, first of all, polio, which is essentially everywhere. I mean, the virus is all over the place. And usually it goes in your mouth and out your bottom, and it doesn't cause disease. And in fact, even at the height of the polio vaccine, if you exposed 100 children to the polio virus, 95 of them or 94 of them showed no symptoms at all. Four or five would show flu-like symptoms, and it was only one out of 100 that was actually coming down with polio. And so from the Scandinavian point of view, it was not a major public health crisis, and they saw and they looked at the vaccines, and they saw all these strange viruses in there, and they said, we are unwilling to inoculate our population with a vaccine that's full of a bunch of monkey viruses that we don't understand the consequences of, all in order to get rid of a disease that's not a problem for us. So they rejected it. They said the question here is, why are the Americans in such a hysteria about this? And I think that's a very interesting question, because polio tended to strike the children of the wealthy for some reason. And then you get the FDR thing in there. What you've got is you had a media-driven hysteria about polio. I mean, the Americans were walking around in armbands gathering
money. It was like the bubonic plague, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, but it was more of a – I mean, there was 35,000 cases of polio a year, and it was called an epidemic. Okay? We have 1.5 million cases of cancer a year now, and it's not called an epidemic. I mean, there's 200,000 cases of prostate cancer a year, and it's not called an epidemic. Why not? I mean, it's the media is playing a role in this whole thing.
All right, back to the phones we go. Sandy's in Cleveland. Go ahead, Sandy.
Hi. Oh, this is a wonderful, wonderful show. Edward, can you explain the reasons and reasonings behind something I remember from childhood in the 50s and 60s? I remember that there were instances of people who had developed cancer and were being treated for cancer or possibly even dying from cancer, being fired from work, losing their jobs because there was a public belief that, in some cases, that cancer was contagious and they didn't want to contaminate the workplace for the other employees. And I remember there were lawsuits brought about this, that the family of or the person who had the cancer would sue the employer over this. And at some point, I seem to remember in the late 60s, maybe early 70s, suddenly, I don't know if it was the American Cancer Society that was being formed or something, but somehow there was a public push to educate, quote unquote, the general populace about the cause of cancer, that it's not contagious, there's nothing to worry about, this is all ignorance, and it adds insult to injury to the patient. Do you recall anything like that, or do you have any comment about it?
Oh, I'm reminded of the peasants at Dr. Frankenstein's castle when you say all that. First of all, it's a great question, and you articulated a lot of things. There is the tendency to blame the victim of a lot of things, and when there is accountability, particularly, and you're from the Ohio area, there's a lot of pollution up there. There's a lot of concerns that the cancer might be coming from something the company is doing, and therefore we would like to get rid of the people with the cancer so we don't have employees around with cancer making it look like we're doing something that's dangerous. And there's a lot of that, the famous case of that, has to do with the asbestos. And W.R. Grace ran the asbestos mines, and Grace also sat, the man, W.R. Grace, sat on the board of directors of Tulane, which
they're,
is...
They're still in bankruptcy, too, over all of this, aren't they?
Yeah, and, but what happened during that was in the trial, they got into what is causing the cancer, and the people defending W.R. Grace, and the charge was that the asbestos was causing the cancer, they started saying, no, it's this monkey virus in the polio vaccine. And they got international experts to come in and testify for it. And that's where why we know a lot about this today is because we got that courtroom testimony.
Ed, when we come back, we're going to take final phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, back at you. Let's go to the final calls. We'll go to Ilona in New Jersey. You're up with us east of the Rockies. Hi there.
Hi. First of all, I want to say I read the book, and it's excellent. I
Super.
Couldn't put it down.
Thank you.
Okay, my question is, if cancer is a virus and a tropoblast, there are cures today. I know that. Why aren't they allowed? Is human life so cheap? Is it population control? Who's dictating this?
George, would you like to answer that?
Well, I don't know who's dictating this. It's the unknown. It's the shadow government.
Yeah.
It's the Illuminati. It's the higher-ups that have so much power, so much wealth that the rest becomes a game.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is it population control?
Well, one can assume that they want to control the population in order to preserve this planet based on their own theories of why we have too many people. And the number I've always heard, they would like to get us down to 500 million. I'm sure, Ed, when you have done your work for your book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, you came across similar things of deception, of greed, and everything else, didn't you?
Yeah, well, greed is really as much of an issue as the eugenics argument, as far as I'm concerned. And there are people out there with a lot of power who hold both motivations. And you know, my main point is the fact that we can't combat these people if we don't understand them and know about them. And so I see the big gap here is an awareness issue that, I mean, thank goodness for things like Coast to Coast where that gives an outlet for this. But the basic issue is there's plenty of good stuff out there that if it doesn't make money for the corporations that sell the alternatives, they don't want it known because it messes up their marketing. I mean, you know, it's the same with the gasoline thing and everything else. I mean, there are great alternatives out there that don't get the light of day because they interfere with the cash flow of the big boys.
Back to the phones. Kate in Austin, Texas, first-time caller. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi. I actually have just discovered that I have celiacs, which is an autoimmune intestinal disease, and it's basically a gluten intolerance that blocks the absorption of the nutrients and vitamins that you absorb through your small intestines. But it weakens the immune system, and it's now said, I've read that 1 in 22 Americans carries a gene to have celiacs. I know that a lot of the insurance companies won't cover anything that has to do with celiacs, and all of our pharmaceuticals, or not all of them, but a lot of our pharmaceuticals have gluten in them. So my question is, have you done any research on celiacs and found any relationship with something like celiacs and what you're doing, and do you think that the FDA could be involved with any of this?
The basic answer to the question is I have not done any research on that particular issue, and it gets pretty close to the medical advice issue that I need to stay away from. The other issue that you raised towards the end of your question, George, help me out here because I'm spacing out what you said right at the end.
She's still with us. Go ahead, Kate.
Oh, yeah, I'm just wondering if you think that the FDA could be involved.
Oh, FDA.
I guess Yeah, I guess where I'm getting is if so many people carried a gene that made them intolerant to something, to where they so intolerant that they couldn't absorb vitamins and nutrients, it brought their immune system down. But the FDA is allowing that specific thing, gluten, to be in a lot of our food. It just seems a little obvious to me that.
Well, let me address the FDA.
They're making our immune systems all really weak.
Let me address the FDA issue for a second. In the ideal world, the FDA is there to protect the people from the pharmaceuticals, but that's not the way it works in the real world, okay? And we find a very interesting situation. There was a fellow by the name of Barr McClellan, who is a lawyer from Houston, who wrote a book that said he knows from personal knowledge that LBJ killed JFK, okay? I find that to be very interesting because Barr McClellan's wife was the controller in charge of the money for the state of Texas, and they have two children, one who was Scott McClellan, who was the White House spokesman under George W. Bush, who got cancer, by the way, and his brother, Mark McClellan, who was the head of the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as long as you got that kind of that crowd running the things, and they're all hooked in with the pharmas and stuff, with the revolving door policy and everything else, what you have is the FDA functioning in concert with the people they're supposed to be policing on our behalf. And who loses on that? I think we do. I think it's a really what we've gotten into with the politically controlled science here is really sad. And on the subject of control, I mean, let me point this out, that when Sarah Stewart was at the National Cancer Institute in the 50s and she discovered the cancer-causing virus, her boss was Al Rabson. Well, Al Rabson happened to marry a woman by the name of Ruth Kirstein. Ruth Kirstein is on record crediting the key moves of her career to Alton Ochsner out of New Orleans because she went to a medical school and Ochsner got her the job at NIH. Okay. Now, what I found weird was in 2001, a friend of mine stopped by NIH and picked up the phone book and gave it to me, the internal phone book for NIH. And I found out that Al Rabson and Ruth Kirstein, the two people that were in direct contact with Sarah Stewart on the subject of the contamination of the polio vaccine and the presence of a cancer-causing virus, are now controlling, or were at the time in 2001, controlling the vast majority of funding coming out of NIH. That's control, as far as I'm concerned.
Lots of it, too. John in Anaheim, California, on the wildcard line. Go ahead, John.
Hi, George. I just wanted to, first of all, say we appreciate you very, very much. You're the only one in America that I know on a nightly basis that are bringing these kinds of things to light.
Thank you.
And we all thank you for what you're doing.
Sure thing.
And also, your guest is absolutely fascinating. This is a very, very, very big puzzle that's been going on for, I would probably say, centuries, the control of the populace. You know, here recently, I think of the Brookings Report, the Iron Mountain Report, what Brzezinski was into, and Kissinger, and even before that, eugenics programs with Nazis. My question is, and you may have touched on this, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about how David Ferry was involved with this Mary's Monkey situation, because I understand he was thinking that he was going to propose a cure for cancer at the same time and did experiments in his own apartment or house. Is that true or is that just bogus?
No, that's true. And he had been working with mice on cancer on his own before this project mm-hmm. came along, which made him sort of an ideal candidate for it. He was also moonlighting for the CIA, training pilots down in Guatemala for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Mm-hmm. He was his other foot was in the mafia in New Orleans. I mean, he was sitting next to Carlos Marcello in court the day that Kennedy was killed. And so Ferry's, he's an awfully interesting guy, and he's certainly at the center of all this. And what they needed him for was basically he knew how to do injections. He was basically the guy that was injecting the cancer back into the mice in the place across the street. And the two little Cuban kids that lived in that building brought the mice over when it was time to kill them in a cardboard box, and they would take away the bodies when they were finished chopping out the tumors and stuff. So all that went on in Ferry's apartment. And of course, Ferry was, you know, he was connected to Jack Ruby.
Right.
Through his things with the mafia down there, Carlos Marcello. There's a lot of detail about all this in the Me and Lee book that that is about to come out. And, you know, the caller here is pretty well-versed in a lot of this stuff. I think you'd really enjoy reading both of these books in detail.
Sounds excellent. I just wonder, just as a follow-up question, and then I'll be through. Have any of your research led you to maybe some overseas, I mean European influences on that particular situation with the spread of manufactured virus and all that type of thing?
You know, there's a lot of overseas influence in the United States, particularly on the financial level.
Right.
And the connections between the United States and England could not be stronger, and it all relates to our Mideast policy and all these other issues on there that, you know, that we could do six more shows on. Specifically about the virus and vaccine issue, I don't see that's the tail that's wagging the dog here. I think most of it's based in the United States, but, you know, there are still questions about Paperclip and where some of those guys were and whether or not they were involved in some of the projects I write about. I mean, my book is essentially the case for an investigation. It's not the investigation itself, because I'm one guy with a word processor. If I had a staff and arrest and subpoena authority, I promise you we'd get to the bottom of a lot of all this, but I don't. So the best I can do is sort of sketch it out and take the evidence that I do have and put the pieces together so people can see how the clock ticks.
What a scandal, isn't it?
It truly is
a scandal.
It is what we live with, and I wish we didn't, you know, because when you're talking about the stuff we learned when we were children, I really believe in this country, you know, the ideals behind it and everything else. And for me to discover all this and is really shocking to me and saddening to me, but I don't think that being quiet about it is where the solution is. I think we need to raise this issue and confront it. And these people really want to take over this sort of control on it, I think they ought to be faced, squared off with people that they're trying to control, and so we get to some resolution of it.
Where you go next?
If not, it's an awfully dark future.
Well, that's true. Anonymous in Covington, Louisiana. Go ahead, Anonymous.
Hi. I got to tell you, I came in kind of late on the show, and you kind of hit a really raw nerve. I was born at Ochsner Hospital.
Uh-huh.
And everything that could possibly be done wrong administratively during the process of me being born, could have gone wrong, went wrong. I almost died. My mother almost died. And the connection that I'm making here is that, coincidentally, my mother was an informant for the FBI who worked for Jack Ruby.
Okay.
And not to mention, you know, now I live in Covington, which is where they test on animals, you know, monkeys.
The Delta
primarily.
Regional Primate Center, yes.
Right.
What did Mom say about Jack Ruby?
That he knew Lee Harvey Oswald. She was introduced to Lee Harvey by Jack Ruby. And
nice.
This is not an unsubstantiated thing. I it drove her crazy for the better part of her adult life. And a lot of times when I was younger, I thought she was just, you know, maybe a little bit more informed than she should be, and maybe she was a little, you know, touch crazy. But then I found the tapes, because she started taping her conversations with her her handler.
Great. Wonderful.
So,
see, George, this is not unique. I mean, what this guy is coming forward with.
His tentacles go everywhere, don't they?
Yeah, but I have a lot of people bring me these sorts of stories and information all over the place about contacts with Oswald and everything else. I mean, there's. What I write about is the tip of the iceberg, and these sort of stories are real, and they're all downstream from this, but they all have something to do with this because, I mean, we even know that Ruby was working for Richard Nixon back in the 40s. I mean, we got documents on that signed by people from Nixon's office. So we know there's a lot of this stuff, and it's been so buried that it's been hard to put together. But I really think this cancer project in New Orleans is at the heart of it. Jack Ruby himself said he was injected with cancer. I mean, he wrote that on a note and handed it to his prison guard. He died suddenly right when he was about to be moved and get another trial. They, of course, did not let Lee into a courtroom. Imagine what Lee would have said in a courtroom.
Well, especially when he said he was a patsy when they arrested him.
Right. But Lee stood in David Ferry's apartment next to Judy and helped Judy with these cancer projects. Lee was intimately involved in all this stuff and knew all the players and knew the upstream people.
In the Oliver Stone movie on JFK, was not the Joe Pesci, wasn't he? Didn't he play David Ferry?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. I mean, and he played it as a whacked out guy.
Well, Ferry was kind of a whacked out guy, but not, what I was really happy about to see that in that movie was Oliver included the mice and the cancer in there. In fact, I've got a tape of Oliver. It's on my website, drmarysmonkey.com. Of Oliver talking about all this cancer stuff in the U.S. Public Health Service hospital and everything else and Ferry's involvement. And he just says that's another movie for another time.
Absolutely. Take a couple more final calls here. We'll go to Tom in Sonoma County in California. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you for having me on again, George.
Sure.
Edward, thank you so much for the work you're doing.
You're welcome.
Quickly. After the hollers I just heard, Under Our Skins, the movie, and they documented very well the corruption at the NIH, and also the union concerned scientists have the integrity and program in science program, and they've been exposing the corruption of the FDA and the EPA. Researchers came out saying how dangerous the radiation is from medical x-rays last week in the national news. I have it all on my blog, toxicreverend.blogspot. Anyways, my question for you was, might it help to try and simplify this for people where these shadow labs, as I think of them, from the shadow government, not the, you know, you call them underground labs, they're not telling everyone what how it really works. And in my mind, it's combinations within combinations where infectious agents can mix and multiply in a pathogenic impact. The toxic chemicals, when they mix, they multiply in their toxic impact. And also the radiation can affect the immune system. And then there's the epigenetic with the genetics. There's a difference there where they found a genetic twin had the same gene but didn't develop the illness because the switch was different in the epigenetic.
Yeah, and the switch is really what's going on in the cancer thing. I mean, it's the off switch that's not working. Well, first of all, I'm delighted to hear the work that you're doing, and the work of those organizations is very important and deserves more light than it's getting on it. If anyone wants to get the book tonight by phone, it's 1-800-556-2012, and I'm offering the book for under the Amazon price from my website, but it's every copy is signed, and that's Dr. Mary's Monkey, which you can get to through the Coast and Coast AM homepage. They've got a link on it right now, so that's probably the easiest thing for you to get to. George?
All right. Super, my friend. Thank you so much, Ed, for spending the 4 hours with us.
You're welcome. Great work.
Dr. Mary's Monkey. What an incredible story. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Tim Banal, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.